I'm going to turn the program over to Rob.
The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. You are welcome. For our reading today, what I did was I took quotes from Endurance by Frank Worsley, who is the main character in our presentation today. I took those quotes and actually built them into sections of the talk. So you'll hear me quote someone. Whenever you're hearing me quote someone directly, you're actually hearing me quote Frank Worsley, who was an explorer in the Antarctic, and he made it back. Spoiler alert, he made it back and spent the later years of his life giving lecture tours. So between the lectures of Frank Worsley, the lectures of Ernest Shackleton, and the photos by their photographer, I think his name was Hurley, this is one of the most well-captured adventures we actually have. So I would encourage you, if you find any of this interesting, go look it up online, because there's pictures, there's video, and there's words from the people who actually endured it. The great Ernest Shackleton, Sir Ernest Shackleton, was in a three-way race for glory. It was the dawn of the 20th century, and the last great prize on the planet was the South Pole. There were three very different men, all aiming to be the first one there. British gentleman Robert Falcon Scott, Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, and Irish adventurer Sir Ernest Shackleton. Well, Captain Scott froze to death. And Amundsen didn't just make the pole, he made it look easy. So Shackleton, he changed the game. He says, yeah, sure, you made it to the South Pole and back, good job, but did you actually walk all the way across Antarctica? No, you just went in and then turned around and came back following your own footsteps? Oh, well, okay then. There's still something left to do. Legend has it that Shackleton put an ad in the newspaper that read, quote, men wanted for hazardous journey, low wages, bitter cold, long hours of complete darkness, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in event of success. By this time, everyone had already heard what happened to Scott. His body is still frozen in the ice to this day. 5,000 people applied to be a part of Shackleton's expedition. 56 were chosen. Years later, Arctic geologist Sir Raymond Priestley would write, quote, for scientific leadership, give me Scott. For safe and efficient travel, Amundsen. But when you're in a hopeless situation, when there seems to be no way out, get on your knees and pray for Shackleton. Good thing too, because their ship, the Endurance, never made it to Antarctica. They could see it from the ship, but by that time, Endurance was already locked in the ice. Eventually, the pressure crushed her, and the men were forced to live on top of the shifting ice floe while the winds punished them. When the ice broke, they took to their three lifeboats and made for the nearest land, a desolate rock called Elephant Island. It was April 15, 1916 when they landed, their first solid ground in 496 days. Shackleton held them together with optimism and sheer force of will. They called him the boss, and they loved him because he was always the man with the plan. First, they would cannibalize two boats to make the third one as strong and safe as possible, and then the boss and his five best sailors would take that boat to go get help. The rest would hunker down and wait. Shackleton and his sailors would ride that tiny sailboat through storms and ice over 800 miles to get back to the whaling station where the expedition had first started. But they did make it. And when they brought back help to Elephant Island, they hadn't lost a single man. That's the story that made front page news. That's the lesson we still teach our kids when they study this age of exploration. Look at their endurance. Look at their toughness. See how they kept their optimism even when things got hard? And that's not a bad lesson, except that it's wrong. Well, I mean, not wrong exactly. It's true, they were plucky. It's just not the right lesson to learn from this story. First off, they got the main character wrong. This story isn't about Ernest Shackleton. It's about Frank Worsley. He was a New Zealander who'd been sailing since he was a boy. He was apprenticed to the Merchant Marine at the age of 15, and by the time Shackleton hired him to skipper the Endurance, he had 27 years of experience in all seas, in all weather, under steam, and under sail. At the start of their journey, Worsley eyed the Endurance with a veteran's skill. She was a masterpiece, 144 foot long, 300 tons, with both sails and a steam engine. She was built for the ice, with a keel of 7 foot thick oak. The hull was 2.5 foot thick in places and sheathed all around with greenheart wood. Before we learned how to make rods out of fiberglass, fishing rods were made from greenheart because it was so tough and it could bend without breaking. By design, the ship was nimble enough for tight work and sturdy enough to take a beating. Unfortunately, well, that was the last of the hopeful signs. Because, yes, sure, Shackleton did have optimism. He was overflowing with it. But the optimism wasn't actually grounded in reality. Worsley wrote that Shackleton was, quote, as romantic as a schoolboy on the subject of treasure, and always believed that he was going to find untold wealth on his expeditions. Why? I don't know. There were never any signs of it, end quote. While the crew was saying their goodbyes and filling out their wills, Shackleton was hiring a photographer, founding his own movie company, hiring a ghostwriter for the future book, and drumming up a bidding war between the newspapers for exclusive rights to print the photos, assuming, of course, they ever made it back. The photographer sized up Shackleton before they even left, quote, from what I can see, Sir E. cares very little for the scientific work, but is eyeing the expedition more in the light of a commercial venture, end quote. By the time they hit Buenos Aires, they were already burning supplies for fuel, and the expedition's geologists had to loan Shackleton money just to buy more coal. Only one of the men on the expedition had any experience handling dog sleds or wrangling sled dogs, and he quit the expedition when Shackleton refused to pay for an insurance policy. On an expedition into the harshest climate the Earth has to offer, they brought a radio receiver, but not a transmitter. They couldn't afford the transmitter. At the whaling station that was their last stop before Antarctica, Shackleton bought them some more coal and winter clothing on credit. The whalers knew these waters better than anyone, and they warned them that the ice was worse than usual this year, worse than anyone could remember. Well, you already know the rest. They didn't stop. What you don't know is how they made it through. The one person who really had it in hand wasn't Shackleton. It was Captain Worsley. Literally. He held the sextant in his hand, and the compass, and the pages he'd ripped out of the atlas before the ship sank, and the pocket watch that didn't really keep exact time anymore, but it lost time at a predictable rate so they could still use it. And he still had the almanac, the book of numbers and logarithms that would allow them to use all those other numbers to calculate their exact position on the globe. While they were stuck in the ice, he was taking measurements. He learned the currents and the winds. He memorized the maps. When the ice floe broke, he was the man on the tiller, 90 hours, no sleep. And after 4 days at sea, he landed them right on Elephant Island. If you want to imagine that feat, think of scoring a bullseye on a dartboard across the width of Freethinkers Hall. And then he did it again, guiding them from Elephant Island back to the whaling station where they first started. During that second journey, over 800 miles of brutal ocean, Worsley was only able to take a sextant reading four times. All the rest is dead reckoning. Dead reckoning is when you take 27 years of experience and add it to the sound of the wind in the rigging and the feel of the spray and the twist of the boat, and you plot the progress of the ship on the map in your head. You go with your gut. 800 miles over 16 days, only four reality checks, all the rest by feel, and he got them there. So hit that first bullseye from across the hall, and then do it again down the length of the hall, and you've got it. This is lessons on how to survive the leadership of confident idiots. Step one, take every opportunity for a reality check that you can get. In his own words, this is how Captain Worsley described their situation. Quote, "Navigation is an art, but words fail to give my efforts a correct name. Dead reckoning, the seaman's calculation of course and distance, have become a merry jest of guesswork. The procedure was, I peered out from our burrow, precious sextant cuddled under my chest to prevent the seas from falling on it. Sir Ernest stood under the canvas with the chronometer and a pencil and a book. I shouted, stand by, and knelt on the thwart, two men holding me by either side. I brought the sun down to the horizon where the horizon ought to be, and as the boat leaped frantically upward on the crest of a wave, I snapped a good guess at the altitude and yelled, stop! Sir Ernest took the time, and I worked out the result. My navigation books had to be half open, page by page, till the right one was reached, and then open very carefully to prevent utter destruction from the seawater. It was misty. The boat was jumping like a flea. Ship seas fore and aft. There was no limb to the sun, so I had to observe the center by guesswork. Astronomically, the limb is the edge of the sun or moon. If blurred by cloud or fog, you can't accurately bring it down to the horizon. The center is the spot that's required. So when the limb is too blurry, you bring the center of the bright spot behind the clouds down to where the horizon should be, and by practice taking a series of sights, you obtain an average that has no bigger of an error than 1 minute of arc. End of quote. So step one, you scratch and claw for every single reality check you can get. Step two, you rely on your expertise when you can't. Worsley made four sightings, two of which were just rough estimates. Everything else was his experience, interacting with what he was seeing and feeling in a way he could never have explained if someone had asked. His subconscious mind was comparing this moment with 27 years of experience and feeding back the results as intuition. Step one, reality check when you can. Step two, trust experience when you can't. Step three, get really, really lucky. This is maybe my favorite story in the entire venture. They get the crew to Elephant Island. They make it 800 miles back to South Georgia Island where they started, but when they land, it's the wrong side of the island. They have to cross this mountainous, glacier-covered island on foot. At this point, the only people still able to move are Sir Shackleton, Captain Worsley, and a sturdy sailor named Crean. The three of them tied off a rope between them so that two could catch whichever one fail, and they started walking. It was nearly night, and they found themselves on the edge of a cliff looking down a slope so steep they couldn't climb down. If they stopped to spend the night at that altitude, they would freeze and never wake up. So they took the rope, and they laid it on the ground like a makeshift toboggan, and then all three climbed on top of the rope, Shackleton in the front, Worsley in the middle, craning in the back, each grabbing themselves around the center, and they pushed. Remembering it later, Worsley said, quote, "We seemed to shoot into space. For a moment, my hair fairly stood on end, and then quite suddenly, I felt a glow, and I knew I was grinning. I was actually enjoying it. I yelled with excitement and found that Shackleton and Green were yelling too." End quote. Screaming like kids on a roller coaster, they slid 1,500 feet down a mountain, and somehow none of them died, not even a cut. When reaching the whaling village, the children ran from them in fear. They looked so awful. And people who knew them when they launched no longer recognized them. When the other three were collected from the far side of the island, the whalers who lived there held a celebration in their honor. Again from Worsley, quote, "Three or four white-haired veterans of the sea came forward. One spoke in Norse, and the manager translated. He said he'd been at sea over 40 years, and he knew no feat of daring seamanship as bringing a 22-foot open boat from Elephant Island to South Georgia. All of the seamen present came forward and solemnly shook hands with us in turn. Coming from brother seamen, men of our own cloth, and members of a great seafaring race like the Norwegians, this was a wonderful tribute." End quote. It was three more months before the weather allowed them to rescue the crew that was left on Elephant Island. On August 30th, 1916, after almost 2 years of endurance, all 28 men were finally safe. They returned to England, but not as heroes. England was bleeding. World War I was inventing new ways to harvest an entire generation, and no one had the stomach for survival stories where everybody came home just fine. We don't control the outcome of our stories, and most of the steps along the way are beyond our control, but Captain Frank Worsley reminds us from 100 years in the past that we do control how we respond to what we endure. We can use frequent reality checks, trusted experience, and a little bit of luck to turn even the most brutal reality into a story worth remembering. As hard as I am on Shackleton, Worsley was not. Worsley loved him like a brother, admired him from the start, and spoke only good of him for his entire life. What he recognized in Shackleton was this amazing ability to hold people together and to maintain positivity and unity in the face of hardship. So even though I think that Worsley deserves more respect than Shackleton, I think maybe Worsley would disagree with me. His book was called Endurance, and then there's also, there was a one, you can find it online by a historian, I think called Alexandria, who included, she collected quotes from many different authors and created sort of a composite story. At the end of her recollection of this, she was really impressed with how well everyone's stories fit together. She said that, you know, the book that Shackleton released was written by a ghostwriter who had access to Shackleton and other men from the event, and also all of their writings, because most of them kept diaries. And the ghostwriter put together what was called South! Which was a very popular book. And she was impressed with how accurate that book turned out to be based on her own, you know, path work going through and redoing all the work. She said that the ghostwriter missed nothing, but put a couple things in the wrong order. But that everything that was in there was true. She was very impressed with their work. I encourage everyone to go do a Google search for Shackleton and look for the photos and the videos, because there's just nothing like seeing this stuff in a way. They're all black and white, but they are clear, beautiful photos and moving pictures to show you what these guys really did endure. It's impressive stuff. Yeah, that was definitely another mark of his leadership. It was part of his style of leadership. was that Shackleton would keep his enemies close. And the person you're talking about was the carpenter, whose name was right. McNish. And the carpenter was just a surly kind of guy who was very, very, like, stunningly competent. He would go, they were in this wooden barkentine ship, and something would break, and he would walk over and look at it, and then he would go back to his shop, and he would cut the board to fit. He just eyeballed it, and it fit. When the part of the reason that the boat was able to survive the second trip, the 800-mile trip, was because that carpenter reinforced it and decked it. You know, he just again and again stepped in and made life-saving, high-quality alterations. And unfortunately, his interaction with Worsley and with Shackleton were so problematic that when it came time to hand out the awards, you know, they gave them medals, Polar Expedition medals. He didn't get one. He was one of three who was, even though he survived the trip, was not allowed to receive an honorary medal, and was pretty, and as infuriating as that sounds, he was, the thing he was upset about was that Shackleton killed his cat. Because he brought a cat on board with them, and the cat became sort of the mascot. And then when the ship broke up and they knew that they were going to have to make a break for it, Shackleton ordered them to shoot the cat because they didn't think it was, Shackleton said it wasn't fair that this cat would not be able to survive and they would spend too much time taking care of it. And so they ordered that the cat be shot, and that was the thing that that sort of broke the relationship forever. And they eventually had to kill all the dogs too, and the men were sad about it, but nobody carried a resentment the way McNish did. That carpenter was furious for the rest of his life. But even though he died pretty much penniless, he was always respected by the other seamen, the other merchant marines who would collect money to take care of him until the day he died. He never had much of a home, but he never wanted for food because the other veterans of the sea respected him so much. And I think it's important. I think step three is also crucial because there were just tremendous amounts of just straight up luck in this story. And if we sort of buy into the American narrative that you control, you're the captain of your own ship and the captain of your own destiny, and you know, whatever happens to you is the thing that you deserve. I think this story is kind of proof of the opposite, that you can do your very best and it still takes, you know, a whole life's worth of luck to get through some really difficult situations. I think we need our left and our right, and we need a little bit of luck. Part of the reason that they did not receive the hero's welcome that they really deserved was because they came back from the war and they lived. And, you know, Flanders Field was growing poppies, you know, like everyone else had lost someone. And here were these guys who came back with their happy story about how everybody survived. And Shackleton kind of shot himself in the foot because he called it the White War. He said, you know, our brothers in arms were out fighting the Red War, and we were down south fighting the White War, as if to like set up some sort of equivalence between going on a polar expedition that you volunteered for and fighting your way through France. And the public kind of had no patience for that, and I think rightly so. But he, like Worsley, made a living off of the speaker circuit. So people still love to hear the story, but he was kind of too glib with the amount of luck that was involved in his story. He took too much credit and people resented him for it. Yeah, they were on the ship leaving for the expedition when the war broke out. And so from the ship, they sent a telegram to the Admiralty and said, we understand there's a war. Do you want us to stay? We're all able seamen. Do you want us to stay? And the Admiralty said, no, it's fine. You go do your thing. So then they come back, or they land at the whaling station, and the first question that Shackleton asks is, "So who won the war?" And they started to cry, and they're like, "You don't understand that there is no winner. The war is still happening, and Europe has gone insane." And then they come back, and they all step up, and a lot of them die. Yeah. So for our closing words, Captain Worsley didn't join the expedition for science. He wanted a life of adventure. And even when he was half frozen and half starved in a 20-foot boat fighting 20-foot waves, he was still right where he wanted to be. He never gave in to anger. He never gave in to despair, but always kept his eyes on the sea and his maps and the stars and his friends. By choosing to see his current horrible circumstance in the light of something larger and something just as real, he was able to achieve his dream, a true adventure. And he created a story so amazing, we still tell it 100 years later.
And I want to thank Rob for a really informative and thought-provoking program. I'm going to sign off. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.